1320 AM, W248DE, Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. President Biden says he does not need a cognitive test to prove he's in good mental condition after last week's debate. He gave an exclusive interview to ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos.
I have a cognitive test every single day. Every day I have that test. Everything I do. You know, not only am I campaigning, but I'm running the world. And that sounds like hyperbole. But we are the essential nation in the world.
There's new hope Israel and Hamas could agree on a plan for peace. A Palestinian official tells the BBC Hamas is no longer demanding a full ceasefire to forge a deal. The BBC's Sebastian Usher is in Jerusalem.
The Hamas position, if this turns out to be 100% correct, really has shifted. And this key obstacle about the permanent ceasefire does seem to have changed. And that is in line with the three-phase proposal that was outlined by President Biden. That puts the ball in Israel's court, in the court of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Heat records are falling in the West. Temperatures are up to 20 degrees above normal in Gresham, Oregon, where Sherry Thompson escaped the heat at a cooling center.
Because I've already had a heat stroke, and so I don't need to have another one. It's way too hot for anybody.
National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Chouinard has the forecast.
Temperatures 20 plus degrees above average. And we are looking at some more records should be broken today across the West. Quite a few potentially, maybe as many as 25.
Tropical storm Beryl is forecast to strengthen in the Gulf of Mexico tomorrow as it nears South Texas. City officials in Corpus Christi gave out 10,000 sandbags to help residents prepare. But homes in the area are not the only concern, as CBS's Janet Shamlian reports.
We are at Sea Turtle Inc., where there are some 8,000 critically endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtles incubating. The eggs are incubating there in the sand, precariously close to the shore. They have built up about a 4-foot sand wall here in hopes of protecting them. Right now, time is running out, and there's really not a good success rate for trying to move them. So they're hoping for the best.
France is holding a second round of elections this weekend. Dr. Karen Donfried is a senior fellow at Harvard University.
The elections on Sunday will determine who the prime minister is, and that's what the government of France looks like. And those stakes are very high.
Heading to Wall Street, stocks finished with gains to end the trading week. The Dow was up 67 points yesterday. The S&P 500 added 30, and the NASDAQ got a bump of 164. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Join us live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. for Playmakers, brought to you by Quality Plus Printing. Call in with your sports thoughts and feelings only on WFHR.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The 988 Crisis Lifeline is now almost 2 years old. A new report says it's making a difference in Wisconsin, but could still be improved. Mike Moen reports.
While the report from the group Inseparable says progress is needed, it notes the change was a critical step toward providing better care. For Wisconsin's operation, the findings show the call answer rate is at 77%, below the desired level of 90%. Abigail Spangers oversees a separate peer-driven helpline in the La Crosse area, says when it comes to the broader service, she would like to see more training that's trauma-informed.
988 is a good overall resource for individuals. However, we find that people are frequently put in a position where they have to navigate those calls differently because if they come up with a trigger word, it could end up triggering a wellness check.
She says in some cases, the caller is simply looking for someone to talk to. In financing state-level systems, the report does credit Wisconsin for having an enhanced Medicaid match for mobile response. But it does call on the Badger State to join others in adopting a telecom fee to help ensure more stable funding. Report authors say the overall goal is to reduce the effects of deficient crisis response. Since 2015, almost one in five fatal police shootings involved a person experiencing a mental health emergency. Inseparables, Angela Kimball says too often, there's a tragic outcome when people can't get the necessary help.
At a less severe level, we see a lot of people who end up in crowded emergency departments, and frankly, emergency departments are getting so filled up.
Meanwhile, the report found that nationally, more than 80% of calls to 988 are resolved over the phone. And for those who require mobile response teams, 70% are resolved in the field. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Through the afternoon, a mix of sun and clouds with an isolated storm or two and a high in the upper 70s to 80. Mostly cloudy, a few storms tonight, low upper 50s. And partly sunny and a storm or two again tomorrow, high upper 70s. Isolated storms still possible on Monday, Tuesday. Currently, it's 66.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up in the show, we'll talk to the Humane Handling Institute about different ways to raise and slaughter our animals. Interesting discussion. Hope you'll join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. Locally grown radio, WFHR. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome to this, our weekly weekend venue broadcast. My name is Jim Santel, and I am your host this hour and next hour as well for our broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. We call our program Amicus, a law review. This is our 105th broadcast since we first went on the air in the networks of Civic Media in the summer of 2022. Delighted and honored to have you with me once again this weekend for our review of all things legal, all things rule of law, all things justice related. We take our name, as you now well know, Amicus, from a legal term. It is derived from the Latin. It describes a friend. Ami is inside Amicus. It's an individual and organization that somehow assists in understanding, appreciation, assessment of some relevant issues or some other challenges, some questions that need resolution to be resolved by a court, for example, a judge, or some other entity that needs information, needs insight and perspective for that decision-making process. That's what gives animation and life to our program. And again, part of that program is your involvement. In our second hour on this weekend broadcast, we're specifically inviting your questions, your inquiries about the subject matter of this broadcast, but also our previous broadcasts, including those of last weekend. Last weekend, I spent virtually all hours, two of them on Saturday, two of them on Sunday, all broadcasting about what? The United States Supreme Court, this major time in our nation's history when the Supreme Court issues all of its most significant rulings in May, June, and yes, in July, the first day of July. We spent time last weekend talking about these 10 major cases decided by the Supreme Court in just the previous week. And because of our attention, necessarily the content, the substance of those, decided not to take callers in our last broadcast. This weekend, just the opposite, inviting very much your phone calls and especially your questions and your inquiries about the subject matter, which, yes, once again, is going to be about the United States Supreme Court. That number is 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. My wonderful producer, Max, also reminds me that you can drop a note in the Civic Media app. Be in touch with us that way. Send your question, your inquiry to Max or me through that process. And we will get to those in our second hour on our weekend broadcast because there are a lot of questions. There are a lot of things that you may want to follow up with and with me and others when it comes to understanding what our Supreme Court has just done. Of course, most important, this broadcast, we're going to be spending some huge amount of time talking about this major case involving Donald Trump, our former president, presently a candidate for the presidency, and the United States. This prosecution that is going forward now in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, based upon four charges brought against him by the special counsel for the Department of Justice, Special Counsel Jack Smith. We have talked a lot about that process. suspended, not proceeded on, while the Supreme Court addresses issues related to the legitimacy, the rightness, the correctness of the charges against him, and specifically this major issue involving whether or not a president, a chief executive of our nation, is entitled to immunity from crimes committed in office. That's the question that the Supreme Court wrestled with. And yes, just last Monday, in what is arguably one of two major decisions issued by the Supreme Court that's going to change our lives, our livelihoods, and our nation, the United States Supreme Court issued a major opinion and found that there is indeed a presumption of immunity that applies to a chief executive in connection with crimes that may have been committed in office. Because of the seriousness of that finding, I'm going to spend a huge amount of time, especially in our first hour on this weekend broadcast, talking with you about exactly what the majority of the United States Supreme Court said, what the Chief Justice John Roberts wrote about. And then we're also going to talk about what the dissenters, three dissenters, said, two in particular, Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson, what they said about this issue of whether or not under our Constitution, under our laws, under our system of the rule of law in America for 248 years, there is indeed a notion in which someone, the President of the United States of America, is above the law. The Supreme Court, even while it's affirming that, yes, indeed, no one is above the law, has made a finding that indeed there are certain things carved out because of the nature of the presidency that require that when it comes to judicial adjudication, resolution of cases and crimes and charges, that indeed a president has immunities in some areas when it comes to criminal acts. And as we have spoken before on this broadcast and others, the perspective that I would offer to you is that that opinion issued by the United States Supreme Court just in the past week changes America. Changes America, and for that reason, we are going to spend a lot of time talking about exactly what the Chief Justice wrote, a couple of things about what one of the associate justices named Clarence Thomas also wrote about the very legitimacy of the special counsel statute, and then also focusing upon these dissenting opinions. And it is important for Americans to understand not only what our Supreme Court has done and said in detail because of the importance of this, but also to understand the countervailing, the opposite argument, which is articulated so very well by the dissenting opinions. We're going to spend a lot of time reading from the opinion so that you can hear what our justices have said on both sides of the decision and making some assessments on your own, of your own evaluation, based upon what you hear, based upon what you can, in fact, consume at any time when it comes to reviewing this all-important opinion. We recall well that the Supreme Court, in the days just before its issuance of this major opinion in Trump versus United States, issued another opinion, a case called Loper Bright Enterprises, in which it basically changed the ways in which government interacts with courts and courts with government, changed the ways in which our administrative agencies operate, reversing 40 years of precedent when it comes to the appropriate deference given to agency officials who know what they're doing, the experts, the people who are experienced in doing this, and change that such that the judges now going forward have the exclusive capacity to make decisions in areas that, with respect, they do not know about. That decision, called Loper Bright Enterprises, issued just before this other opinion on presidential immunity, changes the way that government works. I would offer that the opinion issued by the Supreme Court in Trump versus United States affects to the detriment our Constitution and changes the very ways in which our Constitution is designed, that is, with checks and balances. I have thought a lot about this in the week or so since the Supreme Court issued this opinion, and I have questioned myself about whether or not I'm being hyperbolic, I'm being too extreme in my responding to this particular opinion. And even in preparing for this weekend's program, I revisited that issue as I put together some portions of the opinion, which we will hear from this weekend.
And I've decided that I am not being hyperbolic. You may have a different view about this, but the reality is that our Constitution was changed a week ago by the United States Supreme Court. And it is a Constitution that now advances in the wake of the exaltation of courts, in the wake of that Loper-Bright Enterprises over the decisions of an executive branch, and now an imperial presidency that, as some of the dissenters indicate, have now reestablished something that we have not had. We have not had in 248 years, and that is a king in America. That is not hyperbolic. And I would offer that the language that you're going to hear about today in our broadcast, specifically in this first hour, supports that notion. Again, you, as always, on the Civic Media broadcast stations, free to come to different conclusions. And I want to hear about those, and I want to hear about all your questions and comments about this assessment as we march through what the Supreme Court did a week ago in changing the very constitution of our nation, the very way in which we interact with government, and the very way in which our president now has capacities to do things in the nature of criminal conduct that he, one day she, never had before. James Madison, George Mason, other people, designers of our Constitution, never contemplated that this kind of thing would happen. Now it is a part of our landscape, of our fabric, and we will talk about that and describe in detail what it is the Supreme Court has done. In addition to issuing this major opinion, and as a part of our comprehensive review of those Supreme Court decisions, it is significant to note that in addition to Trump versus United States issued on Monday of last week, the Supreme Court also took care of two other decisions before it decided to go out of business, if you will, for at least a while. They're actually still there. They're still there handling cases during the summertime. And yes, building a docket for the next term, which is the 2024-2025 term. That begins in October of this year. But before they left, before they issued these final decisions, among those final decisions were two others. One of them is called Corner Post Incorporated versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. It has to do with an Administrative Procedures Act case, and specifically a claim with a timing of when this particular claim accrues under a particular statute, finding that a 6-year statute of limitations until the plaintiff is injured by a final agency action is what applies. And there you have another 6-3 opinion, Justices Barrett, Roberts, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh on the majority, establishing a specific rule when it comes to the timing of the filing of a complaint, opposed by Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson on the dissenting side. Corner Post versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System having to do with forms of payments, debit cards, all sorts of financial transactions, the Federal Reserve Board, and issues about whether or not a 6-year statute of limitations is real or not under a particular statute. That case, Corner Post versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. And then another case that actually gives more attention to what the Supreme Court does, and that is Moody versus NetChoice. This is the other social media case. And there you have a 9-0 opinion saying that because the lower courts have not properly exposed and explored the particular First Amendment issues there, no decision there about that particular case, a 9-0 opinion, sending it back down to the circuit courts to decide about various issues there. When we return, we're going to be talking more about not just those cases, but specifically focusing in on Trump versus United States here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
Summer is here and the sun is unforgiving. Be your child's hero this summer by keeping them safe in the summer heat and don't miss a beat. WAM Incorporated is here to help. Summer is for family trips, team championships, and long days at the beach. Design your child or team's gear in a flash with fully customizable polyester shirts and shorts. Call 715-423-9600. 9465 for WHAM Incorporated today and get back out into the summer sun and enjoy the adventure without the burn.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this Civic Media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of Civic Media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids home of Nightlight with Peach Schwabba.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you so much for joining me on our weekend broadcast, as we have in the past two broadcasts and broadcasts even before then. We are talking once again about the United States Supreme Court as they issue their final decisions of this term before they begin to fill up their docket for the next term and entertain oral arguments in the fall of this year. And again, next year at this time, issuing the next set of major opinions at this time of the year, focusing upon the most recent decisions issued just this past week, three of them in particular, this case involving a statute of limitations under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the second case involving social media, finding that the Florida and Texas statutes that require that social media platform providers moderate their own behavior when it comes to content moderation could not properly be decided. Why, according to the Supreme Court? Because both of the lower courts, the circuit courts in the 11th Circuit and the 5th Circuit, failed to properly analyze the specific legislative enactments here under an appropriate First Amendment analysis. They send the cases back down to those circuit courts, perhaps to the trial courts as well, saying, you've got to do a better job. Come back with it to us when you've resolved these issues under a First Amendment analysis. No clear statement by our Supreme Court about whether or not state legislatures can compel social media providers to regard their content moderation processes as subject to legislation, basically requiring that they explain every time they bring down a particular post for being the focus of misinformation or incendiary type information. That's what the legislation basically said. No resolution of that particular issue, that dispute, if you will, between states and the social media providers, until the lower courts wrestle more directly with First Amendment issues. That case, once again, Moody versus NetChoice. The other one, Corner Post versus Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. The two other cases decided at the very end of this term. And then we turn, of course, to the principal focus of our discussion on Amicus, a law review of this weekend. And that is the case of Trump versus United States. As I indicated in our first segment in this first hour, it is a subject of an awful lot of focus, an awful lot of people on both sides of the political aisle looking at this opinion and scratching their heads. You may recall well that there was a time on this broadcast, a time on many broadcasts out there, television, radio, in the newsprint, all sorts of media outlets, indicating that there is no issue here. There is no issue but that an executive of our nation, as understood under our Constitution, is indeed subject to the laws of our nation. And the notion, the idea that somehow a president could commit crimes in office and not be subject to prosecution for those is ridiculous, is crazy. It's basically contrary to the basic tenets of our Constitution. And indeed, for that very reason, I and many other people much brighter, much more experienced than I, took the position early on that when the Supreme Court decided to take this case on, they were plainly going to articulate this view clearly, unequivocally, unanimously, that there is nothing to see here, that the president of the United States of America is not above the law, is subject to criminal prosecution, cannot commit crimes in office. And in fact, we saw during the course of the oral argument a lot of what results in the major Supreme Court opinion of just this past week. That is, the Supreme Court, at least a majority of them, giving an awful lot of regard for this notion that is indeed ridiculous, that somehow our president can commit crimes in office
and not be held responsible for them. We saw that in the oral argument. We're very concerned about it. And indeed, it shows up. It shows up in even a more robust nature in the opinion that the Supreme Court has issued. The majority opinion that I commend to all of you in terms of reading because of the significance of it to the future of our nation, not just in this political season, not just for the presidency as it begins a next term in January of 2025, but for the future of America. We know that in the end, the United States Supreme Court said this, and this comes, as do all of the other recitations this weekend, directly from the order, the opinion of the United States Supreme Court, issued by John Roberts, authored by him, joined in by the majority as well, and with, of course, two dissents, joined by three dissenters, and a couple of concurring opinions, which we will also talk about, coming from Justice Thomas and, very interestingly, from Justice Amy Coney Barrett, separating himself a bit from a key piece of this major order, which we will talk about as well. What in the end does the Supreme Court say definitively and clearly? It is stunning. It is shocking. The Supreme Court says this: we conclude that under our constitutional structure of separated powers, the nature of presidential power requires that a former president have some immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts during his tenure in office. That language should be chilling to all of us, at least with respect to the president's exercise of his core constitutional powers. This immunity must be absolute. And we'll talk about one specific incarnation of that ruling when it comes to the U.S. Department of Justice, which is perhaps the most significant thing that the Supreme Court says. As for his remaining official actions, Chief Justice Roberts writes, he is also entitled to immunity. At the current stage of proceedings in this case, however, we need not and do not decide whether that immunity must be absolute and instead whether a presumptive immunity is sufficient. And so the upshot of all of this is that there are some areas which we will discuss where a president is absolutely immune, no possibility of prosecution for crimes committed, and other areas where there is a presumption of that same kind of immunity that, yes, indeed, has got to be overcome by the government in its presentation of this case. Other aspects of this particular opinion, which we will focus on, are also about the specific ways in which this particular trial can, in fact, go ahead now in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. She is the district court judge who now has this back on her docket for a trial, presumably sometime in the future. We'll talk about the timing of that in future broadcasts. But all of this premised upon a basic notion that is also set forth early in the opinion. This notion of a very muscular and very, very energetic, a very energetic United States executive. Here's what the Chief Justice says. He says the framers sought to encourage energetic, vigorous, decisive, and speedy execution of the laws by placing in the hands of a single, constitutionally indispensable individual the ultimate authority that, in respect to the other branches, the Constitution divides among many. Now, he's acknowledging there plainly that we do have a tripartite Constitution, three branches of government, but note the muscularity of that description, that energy, that vigorous, decisive, speedy execution, which animates all that comes forward. That is a fundamental notion that's set forth in Justice Roberts' opinion here. That vigor is also described when he says this: the framers' design of the presidency did not envision a counterproductive burden on the vigor and energy of the executive. That notion of a very strong, arguably even stronger than the legislative branch, that also animates much of this. Then we go on to talk about presumptive immunity. And as our discussion continues, we'll hear from the Chief Justice and the majority about what exactly that means and how it implicates the future of our nation, right here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. President Biden says he does not need to take a cognitive test after his halting debate performance last week. He gave an exclusive interview to ABC News anchor George Stephanopoulos.
I have a cognitive test every single day. Every day I have that test. Everything I do.
Hamas and Israel may have a path to peace. The BBC's Sebastian Usher is in Jerusalem with more on a possible concession.
There is an unnamed Hamas source who's being quoted this morning saying that this Hamas proposal would accept that it would no longer demand a permanent ceasefire from the very start.
Heat records are dropping like flies in the West. National Weather Service meteorologist Mark Chouinard.
Phoenix is Arizona, 118. The previous record was 116. Palm Springs, California hit 124. I believe that's their all-time record high. Previous daily record was 120.
CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Brewers hit another grand slam.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers and the Dodgers in L.A. for game two tonight. Last night, in the top of the fourth, Milwaukee trailing the Dodgers in L.A. 2-1. Bases loaded, one out, and Rhys Hoskins, in a hitting slump, is at the plate on Bally Sports Wisconsin.
Fly ball deep left center field. It is up. It is going to be gone. Did he catch that ball? No, he did not. It's another grand slam. Are you kidding me?
The crew took a 5-4 lead, but it wasn't enough. The Dodgers came back in the eighth to beat Milwaukee by a final score of 8-5. Did Rhys Hoskins meet in Pat Murphy's office on Thursday about his 0-12 slump in Colorado this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what he's got to feel great about it, you know what I mean, to put that good swing on that pitch from a pitcher like Glasnow and gave us a chance to win.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Through the afternoon, a mix of sun and clouds with an isolated storm or two and a high in the upper 70s to 80. Mostly cloudy, a few storms tonight, low upper 50s. And partly sunny and a storm or two again tomorrow, high upper 70s. Isolated storms still possible on Monday, Tuesday. It's 69 degrees right now.
Monday, you're already late for work. You scramble, putting on pants while brushing your teeth in the dark. And you're starving. Starving. But the only thing in the fridge? Friday night's leftovers. Oof. A three-day-old curry beef burrito for breakfast? Big gamble. Ho-Chunk Gaming Wisconsin Dells? Better odds. We're your can't-miss hotspot for big-time casino fun. Ho-Chunk Gaming, Wisconsin Dells. Your odds are better here.
What does your retirement look like? With Fidelity Wealth Management, a dedicated advisor can help you grow and protect your wealth. They'll look at your full financial picture and help you create a flexible retirement income strategy that considers things like market conditions and healthcare expenses so you can reach your wealth's full potential. Visit fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Advisory services offered by Fidelity Personal and Workplace Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor for a fee. This advertisement is brought to you by Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
The 2425 Local in Lovin' It mini magazine is available now out in your community. Once again, you can pick up your books at participating businesses and nonprofits. For just $20, you can enjoy recipes, jokes, contests, and festivals, save tons of money in the area. You can even find great deals on food, drinks, golf, groceries, and most of the area boutiques. In need of a service? Enjoy savings on tires, paint, windows, travel, and mobility equipment. And now you can receive $10 a month at Ho-Chunk Casino in Nakusa. Don't forget, you can also play contests and win gift certificates within your community. Listen for Local and Lovin' It radio ads throughout the month on 97.5 FM and 1320 AM WFHR and 105.5 FM WIRI, and get your books at businesses like Avocados Mexican Grill, Cal's, Wisconsin Rapids Convention and Visitors Bureau, Danny's K Pub and Grill, Hoozles on 54, Square Bar, Mickey's Tip Up in Kellner, and North Brewing Company in Rome. Let the savings begin with Local and Lovin' It mini magazine, available today.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday on Up North News Radio, we'll discuss the latest Republican power grab and the reasons to vote in August against two constitutional referendums.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning starting at 6.
Mm-hmm.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour as well. In our second hour, taking your phone calls, your inquiries, your questions about the subject matter of our discussion this morning. That number, 844-967-2789. Taking all of those inquiries in the wake of our broad and comprehensive review, not only of previous decisions, but on this broadcast, a very exhaustive, in-depth exposition of what our Supreme Court said about this all-important case, Trump versus United States of America, that changes who we are, changes how our government works, changes the very fabric of our Constitution and the life of our nation as we go forward. Talking about this notion established by the Supreme Court now a week ago that there is a presumptive immunity, presumed immune is the presidency of the United States of America. The Chief Justice writing this, taking into account these considerations, and once again, he is talking about a very energetic, a vigorous, a muscular, decisive, and speedy executive branch that perhaps gives more focus to and more strength to the executive branch than our Constitution authors anticipated. Remember that the first article of the Constitution, plainly our founders anticipated that it would be the legislature that is the beefy, very vigorous and decisive entity. Now, according to the Supreme Court, it's not that. It is the executive branch. And oh, by the way, according to the Supreme Court in this term as well, it's also the courts which have this major role coming from the third article of the Constitution. They also have this huge role in this case, identifying for the first time in our nation's history an immunity that attaches to our chief executive for crimes, an executive who now, contrary to what the Supreme Court says in its majority opinion, certainly seems to be above the law. And indeed, that is exactly what the Supreme Court establishes when the Chief Justice says, taking into account these considerations of this muscular and very active and vigorous executive, we conclude, he says, that the separation of powers principles explicated in our precedent necessitates at least a presumptive immunity from criminal prosecution for a president's acts within the outer perimeter of his official responsibility. A lot of words there. Basically, the assumption going in is that if there are things within the scope of official responsibilities, there is a presumption that that president, whoever he or she may be, is immune from prosecution. Such an immunity, the Chief Justice goes on to write, is required to safeguard the independence and effective functioning of the executive branch and to enable the president to carry out his constitutional duties without undue caution. Note that right now. Note that Sonia Sotomayor notes that in her dissent and asks whether or not there should, in fact, be some caution by our chief executive. Indeed, there should. The court goes on to say, if presumptive protection for the president is necessary to enable the effective discharge of his powers, when a prosecutor merely seeks evidence of his official papers and communications, it is certainly necessary when the prosecutor seeks to charge and try and imprison the president himself for his official actions. And here we go. The court says, at a minimum, the president must therefore be immune from prosecution for an official act, listen to this, unless the government can show that applying a criminal prohibition to that act would pose no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. Note that once again as we talk about the dissents a little later in our broadcast. And note the significance of that. Not only is there a presumption of immunity, but it is now the obligation, Jack Smith and presumably future prosecutors, that when it comes to determining whether or not there is an immunity that attaches at all, it is the government's obligation to show that the charges that are brought in this particular case present no dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. Wonder out loud whether that can ever be the case. It imposes a burden upon the prosecution that we have never heard from before in 250 years of history, and that now, according to the Supreme Court, is also going to be a part not only of this particular trial, but other trials down the road. The court does go to great length to say, from the pen of the Chief Justice, that as for a president's unofficial acts, that is, things done presumably in his or her personal capacity, as it was discussed during the oral argument,
there is no immunity, and describes the principle set out in a case called Clinton versus Jones, all those kinds of things. The separation of powers, the Chief Justice says, do not bar a prosecution predicated on the president's unofficial acts. And the concern there, of course, is that by virtue of the definition given to all of this, it is difficult, if not impossible, to identify what those unofficial acts would be that would provide for an unfettered access to a prosecution on those unofficial acts. All of that, a part of the oral argument now a part of the official opinion here. And so in the wake of those fundamental notions, an aggressive, a muscular, a very vigorous executive branch identified arguably more powerful than the other two, contrary to the way that our Constitution was set up, and this notion that the presumption applies across the board to a president and must be affirmatively disproved by a prosecution in a criminal setting, all of that leads the court to say, we're now going to offer some guidance about how you implement all of this. The Chief Justice says, we offer guidance on these issues. And here we go. Here we go when it comes to understanding exactly how this plays out in five different components of the indictment against Donald Trump. This is the introductory language in the opinion. Certain allegations, such as those involving Trump's discussions with the acting attorney general, which again form a core piece of the indictment, those are readily categorized in light of the nature of the president's official relationship to the office held by that individual. That's introductory language, but as we will hear and note in just a moment or so, what the justices are saying there is that as to those communications, as to those engagements between the chief executive and the Department of Justice, those are absolutely immune. Don't touch those at all. No presumptive immunity. Those are off the table completely. And then with respect to four other categories involving the vice president, fake electors, others involved in this scheme to undermine our 2020 election results, and communications on January 6th, as to all those other things, this is what the Chief Justice writes. He says other allegations, such as those involving Trump's interactions with the vice president, state officials, and certain private parties, and his comments to the general public, present more difficult questions. Although we identify several considerations pertinent to classifying those allegations and determining whether or not they are subject to the immunity, that analysis ultimately is left best to the lower courts to perform in the first instance. That, again, an indication that all of this coming back to the trial court to sort out these new principles, with the exception of engagements and communications with the Department of Justice. There is more when it comes to the way that that trial will be conducted. And it is sort of in the initial portions of this opinion as well. And it has to do with another change in the way that criminal cases will be prosecuted when they involve the president of the United States of America. As we've talked on a routine basis on this broadcast, it is a key part of any criminal prosecution that the government, which has the burden of proof, absolutely remains with the government at all time beyond a reasonable doubt. All of that also requires that the prosecution show intent and purpose and often motive as well. Here, the Supreme Court says that particular element, the motive element, that in fact is not a part of the prosecution. And so the court says this, in dividing official from unofficial conduct, courts may not inquire into the president's motives. Such an inquiry, the Chief Justice writes, would risk exposing even the most obvious instances of official conduct to judicial examination on the mere allegation of improper purpose, thereby intruding on the Article II interests that immunity seeks to protect. What he's saying, in other words, is you can't inquire into the reasons why the defendant, in this case Donald Trump, did what he did. No motive, Jack Smith, can be introduced in the course of the trial itself. No look at the proper motive, the animation, the purpose behind doing that, contrary to the way that every single criminal prosecution is pursued in America and beyond. Then let's get into the specifics of these five different areas: the Department of Justice, the Vice President, the fake electors, others involved in this scheme as alleged, and communications on January 6th in particular. Court goes on to say that investigations and prosecutorial decision-making is the special province of the executive branch. They get that particular right, particular aspect right. For this reason, the Chief Justice says, Trump's threatened removal of the acting attorney general implicates conclusive and preclusive presidential authority. This is going in the wrong direction. As we have explained, he goes on to say, the president's power to remove executive officers of the United States whom he has appointed may not be regulated by Congress or reviewed by the court. The president's management of the executive branch requires him to have unrestricted power to remove the most important of his subordinates, such as the attorney general, in their most important duties. That is stunning language coming from the Supreme Court. And here is the lesson. If it's not clear up to now, here is the absolute immunity that a president now has in connection with committing crimes when it comes to engagements with the Department of Justice. The indictment's allegations, in this case, the justice is talking about, that the requested investigations were shams or proposed for an improper purpose, do not divest the president of exclusive authority over the investigative and prosecutorial functions of the Justice Department and its officials. The president cannot be prosecuted for conduct within his exclusive constitutional authority. Trump is therefore, hold on, absolutely immune from prosecution for the alleged conduct involving his discussions with Justice Department officials. Let me read that again. The defendant, Donald Trump, is therefore absolutely immune, cannot prosecute, cannot be found guilty of proven offense conduct, absolutely immune from prosecution for the alleged conduct involving his discussions with Justice Department officials. That is taken off. That is off the table, and not only for this trial, but down the road, any engagement of a criminal nature, incurring Justice Department officials to undergo and undertake inappropriate, illegal, unlawful investigations, do other things under the authority of the Attorney General and the many investigative units that collectively comprise the Department of Justice, directing the Attorney General to engage in criminal conduct, absolute immunity. Can't touch that. That is as a result of what the Supreme Court has written just this past week. Then we get on to the other areas involving, again, the vice president. A discussion here as well about the relationship between the vice president and the president. Arguably, the good news here is that there is no absolute immunity, but presumptive immunity for all of these other things, including things said to the vice president. Whenever the vice president and the president discuss their official responsibilities, they engage in official conduct. And that certainly is not disputable. That's what the Supreme Court says. Presiding over the January 6th certification proceeding at which members of Congress count the electoral votes is constitutional and statutory authority of the vice president. The question then, according to the Chief Justice, is whether that presumption of immunity is rebutted under the circumstances. And stunningly, the Supreme Court says the president may frequently rely on the vice president in his capacity as president of the Senate to advance the president's agenda in Congress. When the Senate is closed and closely divided, for instance, the vice president has to act. But in the end, applying a criminal prohibition to the president's conversations discussing such matters with the vice president, even though they concern his role as president of the Senate, may well hinder the president's ability to perform his constitutional functions. And therefore, we've got this lesson. It is ultimately the government's burden to rebut the presumption of immunity when it comes to those engagements, even if they are criminal in nature. We therefore remand to the district court to assess in the first instance, with appropriate input from the parties, whether a prosecution involving Trump's alleged attempts to influence the vice president's oversight of the certification proceeding in his capacity as president of the Senate would pose any dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. Stunning language. When we return, more focus on that and also the focus on the other areas where presumptive immunity now applies as to the crimes of any sitting or future president of the United States of America.
This is Locally Grown Radio, WFHR. Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for Matt Nair on air.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are marching through some of the major language written by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and issued to America just this past week, establishing this notion that with respect to the criminal conduct of a sitting and future president, there is immunity that attaches to those, absolute immunity for engagements with the Department of Justice, permission to commit crimes when it comes to engagements with the United States Department of Justice, and as to even things related to vice presidential communications, a presumption of immunity that needs to be rebutted and overcome by a prosecutor. And so the Supreme Court telling us then once again that on remand to the district court, that judge, Tanya Chutkan, has got to figure this all out. And is telling her in particular that the Trump's attempts to influence the vice president's oversight of the certification proceeding in his capacity as president of the Senate has to determine whether that would pose any dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. Note that once again for the dissents coming up as we discuss those as well, finding in the end that these are difficult questions, and indeed they should not be, but for the Supreme Court they are, and finding that with respect to the vice president, not absolute immunity, but a presumption of immunity, sort that out, lower court. And then the court goes on to say that the remaining allegations cover a broad range of conduct, and indeed they do. They focus on the fake elector scheme. They focus on other engagements with government officials, with others involved in this attempt to undermine the 2020 election, and then indeed communications on January 6th. All of that, the Supreme Court giving basically a roadmap for how the court should resolve these things. And as to all of those engagements, presumptions of immunity attach to be overcome, if at all, by the prosecution, and establishing as a matter of law now that in the case of fake electors and these other situations, that the government is obliged to show that the immunity does not attach if indeed they can establish that it will not somehow intrude into this very muscular and energetic executive that they are now describing. The president's broad power, the court says, to speak on matters of public concern does not exclude his public communications regarding the fairness and integrity of federal elections simply because he is running for re-election. And that certainly is the case. Similarly, the president may speak on and discuss such matters with state officials, even when no specific federal responsibility requires his communication, to encourage them to act in a manner that promotes the president's view of the public good. The government, however, of course, articulates an allegation in its indictment that there is an extent to which that can go too far, and criminal advocacy for criminal conduct is that bridge too far. In the end, the Supreme Court says we're not going to decide that. Determining whose characterization may be correct between the defense characterization and the government prosecution, and with respect to which conduct requires a close analysis of the indictment's extensive and interrelated allegations, again, having to do with fake electors and other people communications. Unlike Trump's alleged interactions with the Justice Department, the Chief Justice writes, and there again, what is the rule there? Absolute immunity when it comes to the Justice Department.
This alleged conduct cannot be neatly categorized as falling within a particular presidential function. Really? Really? If indeed the government is in fact victimized by attempts at criminal conduct when it comes to the operation of government, we can't identify that as criminal behavior. The necessary analysis, the Chief Justice goes on to say, is instead fact-specific, requiring assessment of numerous alleged interactions with a wide variety of state officials and private persons, and the party's brief comments at oral argument indicate that they starkly disagree on the characterization of these allegations. Yes, indeed, Mr. Chief Justice, that's what the trial is all about. These concerns we noted at the outset. The expedition of this case, the lack of factual analysis by the lower courts, the absence of persistent briefing by the parties thus become more prominent. He is complaining there about the fact that the lower courts did not properly wrestle with the fine issues that he is now defining for the first time in our nation's history. We accordingly remand to the district court to determine in the first instance, with the benefit of briefing, that we lack whether Trump's conduct in all these areas qualifies as official or unofficial, whether or not presumptions of immunity do in fact apply, or whether somehow this can be categorized as outside that ambit, and for that reason only subject to criminal prosecution. As to the public communications, the court goes on to say that the president, in fact, believes that he may in fact be advancing a public interest. Goes on to say he is even expected to comment on those matters of public concern that may not directly implicate the activities of the federal government. For this reason, most of the president's public communications are likely to fall comfortably within the outer perimeter of his official responsibilities. That's a way of saying to Judge Chutkan, you make the assumption that virtually all the things in these communicative pieces during the course of this conspiracy to undermine the 2020 election, to overturn the results of the votes in America, the communications on January 6th, assume going in, Tanya Chutkan, that all of those are within the perimeter of official responsibilities and therefore not subject to criminal prosecution. Knowing, he says, for instance, what else was said contemporaneous to the excerpted communications, or who else was involved in transmitting the electronic communications, organizing the rally, could be relevant to the classification of each communication. This necessarily fact-bound analysis is best performed by the district court. We therefore remand to determine in the first instance what is going on here. And beyond that, as we said, some major decisions about how evidence will be presented during the course of this trial. And here it is, very important to understand not only this, but something that one of the associate justices, Amy Coney Barrett, takes up in her concurring dissent, which we will get to in our second hour. The Supreme Court says this: the government does not dispute that if Trump is entitled to immunity for certain official acts, he may not be held criminally liable based on those acts. But it nevertheless contends that a jury could consider evidence concerning the president's official acts for the limited and specific purposes, and that such evidence would be admissible to prove, for example, knowledge or notice of the falsity of his election fraud claims. In other words, you got to be able to present evidence of what is official, what is in the ambit of things given to a president by the Constitution, to understand how those things are violated by the criminal law. The Supreme Court goes on to say this: we're not going to have that. The proposal threatens to eviscerate the immunity that we have recognized. In our second hour, more on what the Chief Justice says. We're going to hear also from the dissenters, and then take your phone calls at 844-967-2789 here on Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up in the show, we'll talk to the Humane Handling Institute about different ways to raise and slaughter our animals. Interesting discussion. Hope you'll join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Don't you score a new ride? Find a deal that hits out of the park.
with Johnson & Sons, your neighborhood Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep dealer and service center, serving Wisconsin Rapids and central Wisconsin area for over 84 years through four generations. See the difference that family can bring. Serving Wisconsin Rapids, Stevens Point, Marshfield, Clover, Weston, and Cronenwetter. Take a swing. Don't miss out on these great deals at Johnson Chrysler Jeep in Wisconsin Rapids.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.